starting to be good. Acute respiratory distress syndrome in adults. And this is actually the same thing. It used to be called adult. But then they figured out that, you know what? These people are just like those preterm infants. They don't have no surfactant. Well, in the case of the preterm, it's because they're not old enough. In the case of these individuals, part of that syndrome is that they lose those type 2 pneumocytes. So yes, they do lose surfactant. But it can result from a direct or indirect lung injury that results in inflammation, especially if it involves the systemic inflammatory response syndrome. Y'all have heard many times, and if you've been listening for the last year, one of the things that we recognize with severe COVID is that they do have that cytokine storm. And we'll talk about that more with septic shock. But with ARDS, it also comes into play because the surge response is what gives rise to all of it. ARDS, septic shock, and DIC. Do y'all remember DIC? Disseminating intravascular coagulopathy. All three of those stem from or are caused by the systemic inflammatory response syndrome. In this case, some agent of inflammation caused by either direct or indirect lung injury sets the stage for this response. The cellular mediators that are released initiating further release of humoral. So it's like it never does downregulate. The normal flow of life inside your body is the inflammatory mediators are stimulated, something turns it off. Usually the T cells, but it backs off. It is down-regulated, so you don't have a blast of histamine. You don't have a blast of the cytokines. They go back to previous levels. Well, in this case, that down-regulation never happens. It just keeps up-regulating, up-regulating, up-regulating to where you have now a systemic inflammatory response. So then it begins to leak into the alveoli, causing what is best described, and if you had to describe ARDS in a nutshell, it is non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. If you remember that, and we talked about pulmonary edema several times, we talked about cardiac failure a few times, you should be able to tell me everything I need to know about ARDS right now. It's non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Why not? This x-ray, that's it. Okay, so I've got normal on top. And I'm not trying to make you a junior radiologist. I'm trying to illustrate what we mean by white it out. On top is normal. Well, almost. She's got some positive coming. We'll talk about that later. The middle one is where they have early ARDS. You see those pulmonary infiltrates, that white stuff, that's fluid in the pulmonary vasculature. So remember, non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. There's nothing wrong with the heart. It's the lungs that are, for whatever reason, fluid is being pushed or is leaking into the alveoli. In its worst form, ARDS, their lungs are basically whited out because they have so much pulmonary edema inside the pulmonary vasculature. So here are the common causes, and some of them will really take you by surprise. The direct ones are pretty, they make sense. Aspiration, pneumonia, especially if it's a gram-neg. Now, some of the gram-positives are pretty good about it too. Staph and strep, especially pharyngeal strep, it's a bad one. But, so we look for those. O2 toxicity. That's going to, if we have to really run up that pole for 60, 70, 80% to keep somebody who's in acute respiratory failure, and we have to use those kinds of levels of oxygen, we're causing more inflammation, more of those cytokines are getting flooded in, and it could tip them toward ARDS and the systemic response. Pulmonary contusions, those are the ones that have really broken my heart many times, where trauma victims end up with pulmonary contusions. And I think I might have told y'all this story too. I had a young kid bull rider. The bull stepped on him, had a huge head injury, survived the head injury. We made it over Maxwell. He started waking up, started flooding out. We could not get him cannulated for ECMO. He was 22 years old. So the pulmonary contusions may not seem that bad at first, but remember, with any injury, you're going to have max swell of 3 days. So they could keep on swelling inside their lungs to the point where it becomes ARDS. Toxic inhalation injuries, this would be smoke inhalation injuries. That's the one that I come in contact the most with. But anything where they inhale something toxic will cause those as well. Near drowning, and the transthoracic radio also sometimes triggers. But that's less and less because they now have targeted x-ray giving them. Fibrillary injuries, those are the ones that really, like I said, can take you by surprise because they're nothing to do with the lung initially. Sepsis, if somebody has urosepsis, they have a urinary tract infection, they're a little old lady, so they don't have the usual toxic signs and symptoms. They come into the ER, obtunded, and with, you know, all the signs that we'll talk about is sepsis, and oh, now they can't breathe. That's oftentimes the case. Cardiopulmonary bypass. You mentioned in rare instances, and this really doesn't happen very often, where it gets the systemic response. This one, pancreatitis, that does happen quite a bit. Pancreatitis, nothing to do with the lung, it's the pancreas that sets the stage for that systemic inflammatory response and does ARDS. So don't get your drawers around your ankle. If they have pancreatitis, watch their breathing. Shock state, any kind of shock state. Now remember, septic shock is the number one cause of it, but it could be hypovolemic shock, it could be anaphylactic shock, any of those shock states can initiate that septic or that systemic response. Hypotransfusion, meaning if they get lots of transfusions. And there is no benchmark or no number that tips them over, it's their response that you need to watch. So if you know that they've had multiple transfusions, what are you going to do? What are you going to be watching for? This is non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. We're talking lung involvement. Okay, let me set the stage. 36-year-old, 4th C-section, uterine rupture, requires 54 units of blood to turn her around. And you know that sets the stage for this type of acute respiratory failure. What are you going to do? You're going to be watching blood vessels. That's right, we'll talk more about what those are. It's going to be the same as for acute respiratory failure, by the way, as for what we need today. What? No, this is ours. Where one of those, it could be one, it could be type 1 or type 2 acute respiratory failure, if it's a direct lung. The thing about ARDS is it can result from non-pulmonary, nothing to do with the lungs. I had a guy with snake bite, got bit by a copperhead, and ended up in ARDS. Now, he turned around, we didn't have to ventilate, and that's something to remember, too, where we'll talk about it, catching it early, like anything else. That's the key. So, anyway, so what are you going to do? Going back to my other question. You know she's at risk for it. This is an easy one. It's going to involve something you hang around your neck all the time. You're going to be listening to breath sounds. And instead of just doing it with your initial assessment, you might want to move that to clinical judgment. I'm going to listen more often. I'm not going to wait for shift change. I'm going to be doing this every couple of hours. I'm going to be listening to see if there's a check. And of course, there are two sessions. Shock states, hypotransfusion, DIC, disseminating intravascular coagulopathy, will also initiate ARDS. It's kind of which comes first, the chicken or the egg, in that regard. This one can initiate, remember, because they all come from what? be shrapnel in the leg, or somebody, you know, caught a propeller because they were out skiing and drinking and having a great old time, and now they can't move. Now, pathophysiology is first you have the injury. Some part of the inflammatory response to that injury stimulates the surge response, basically. So first you have inflammation, the cytokines do not downregulate, the stimulation of those, so it does not downregulate. Proteins and fluids move from the capillary bed into the alveoli. So fluid in the alveoli is never a good thing. That's called drowning, right? The proteins are pulled in there by the pressure gradient change. And that's the thing that makes ARDS different than all other forms of acute respiratory failure, is that the pressure gradient changes pull protein into, so it starts getting bony. The same thing happens in pulmonary edema, just a different origin. In this case, it's non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? So we've got proteins and fluid bubbling in those alveoli, preventing gas exchange. So that's where the hypoxemia comes from very quickly. There's a reduction in type 2 pneumocyte production of surfactant. Sometimes it kills off the type 2s completely, but more often it makes them just unable to make surfactant. So what does surfactant do?
Keeps the alveoli open.
Kind of. It reduces the surface tension, so it makes your work of breathing easier. So what do you think you're going to notice as they start losing surfactant? They're going to be working like a big dog to breathe. Faster, deeper. Remember, the first thing that changes respiratory rate usually. So listen to that. Decreased ventilation is the result from that. Alveoli continue to fill up with this foam. And because it's, remember, it's a mixture of protein and fluid, serous fluid at that. Capillary surrounding are congested with that stuff. And that's when you start seeing these infiltrates. Now, if you had x-ray eyes, you'd see the infiltrates before we see the clinical sign. The first clinical sign is with refractory hypoxemia. We take this guy, and I'll give you an example, C7 fracture after a motorcycle accident. He comes in, C collar's intact, neuro intact, but at 7:30, he tells me, I'm having a hard time breathing. So, nursing judgment, I put nasal cannula on, thinking that maybe this is just because he sounds okay at this point. 9 o'clock, his respiratory rate's going up, and he's still telling me I'm just really having a hard time breathing. By midnight, he was intubated. That refractory hypoxemia, every time I go up on the oxygen, his O2 set and his oxygen is, we did ABGs, I think, earlier in the night. But anyway, O2 either keeps going down or it stays the same. So refractory hypoxemia is usually the first recognizable, aha, this is ours. We can't see it and appreciate it at that point, but there's also shifting of the blood from the non-working alveolar units to a working alveolar unit. It's kind of a fail-safe that the body has. It's pulmonary shunting is what that's called. When the body, the lungs, reduce the blood flow to those flooded out alveoli that aren't carrying oxygen, it shifts the blood flow more to those that are working. So that's called shunting. Now here's a picture that shows everything that happens with ARDS. So the first thing that happens pathophysiologically to the tissue is the swelling of the bronchial epithelial. Then you'll start seeing a reduction in the erythritol drawings, platelet activation factor, all of those chemical mediators are a part of that cytokine storm. So you have this soup of chemical mediators all doing damage to some part of this alveoli. And the here's a normal type 2. So you can see where the biliary is off that cell, the producer surfactant are less and less. And here's inactivated surfactant that's just floating around doing nothing. Another big change is that because of PAP, we now have platelets coming into this capillary. So what's that going to do? If you have platelets being activated, that means they're aggregating, they're clumping in this capillary. So what's that going to do to overall oxygenation? Remember, you have to have ventilation and perfusion. All of this is really, really wreaking havoc on ventilation because nothing can get through that soup. And now we have a perfusion issue because of all the platelets that are aggregating in the capillary. So it is definitely a VQ mismatch from both angles, both ventilation as well as perfusion. And all these are the same. The macrophages are often damaged because of the chemical mediators. The other big change is to the capsule, is what I call it, but the membrane of the alveoli becomes very thick. And that may be permanent. So we'll talk about the stages in a moment. So there's a lot going on, and we can just go back to this and follow that and make like a linear. I couldn't do it on PowerPoint, but it's almost a linear step-by-step process in the pathophysiology as a result of either direct or indirect. There are stages to acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. The first is the exudative. That's 24 hours after the insult. Up to, it can actually start like it did with my kid, the motorcycle kid. It can start very early. Very early. That's what's called acute. But it can go, this exudative phase can even begin to arise as up to 24 hours. So you have increased capillary permeability, leaking proteins. If you were to take a chest x-ray at this point, what would you probably see? Lots of white fluffy stuff, but you don't have x-ray eyes. So the next thing we're going to see is blood cells overwhelming the lymphatics, and you start getting that foamy stuff. That's when you'll start hearing very coarse rouse. They'll be diminished in the basis, but they'll be rouse because there's fluid in the interstitium as well as in the ventilatory units as well. So they have both rouse and bronchi. They're very coarse. The early signs and symptoms, tachypnea is number one. Always remember that. If they're tachypneic, there's something wrong. That's the first thing that happens when you can't get enough oxygen on board is your respiratory rate goes up. You become restless. Now the first sign, and unfortunately we don't catch them often at this point, but they're breathing so fast to try to oxygenate that they actually have a respiratory alkalosis. If we were to do blood gases at that point, unfortunately, most of the time when they get to the ER, it's way past that. Because they're at home thinking that this is a bad case of the flu or something. Okay? So respiratory alkalosis, so your PCO2 is going to be greater than 35, correct? They may or may not have a headache. You go back to those signs and symptoms, and they may or may not be a little obtunded, depending on how high their CO2 is. So, PO2 at this point will usually be within normal limits. It'll be low. It's not going to be 120 or 100, even 100 maybe, but it'll be okay. And that's why we don't catch it, unless we put all the pieces together, because that we focus so much on the metatusac. But that's got to be something you step back and go, let me look at how they're breathing, how much work it's taking, and all those signs we talked about before of respiratory compromise. Because if it's worse, If we did have a sworn in, the PA questions would also be normal, so, because remember, this is non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So the PA questions are not affected until way past the exudative phase. So their guesses are going to be something like 7.47, 82, with a CO2 of 30, maybe 38, or maybe a little bit of CO2 is of 42. So, and their SAT's going to be around 94, because they're not hypoxic until much later. Now, what do we say was the hallmark? If you're really on your toes, you're breathing faster. What else do you start looking at? What's the first clinical sign of ART? You go up, you put them on 4 liters, and they're still breathing like big dogs. The second phase is proliferative. There is destruction of those type 2s at this point and less surfactant, so they are going to be breathing. They're going to labor. They're going to be working to try to breathe. Decreased surfactant is going to lead to that. It will also decrease their functional residual capacity. What's FRC? Y'all don't talk about capacities because this isn't respiratory therapy school, but it comes into the conversation a lot. Remember, they're our new best friends when it comes to any kind of ventilatory scenario. It's what's left in their capacity, the volume, the pressure exerted by the volume left in your lungs after a normal respiration. Not after forced, it'll be left after forced exhalation. So your vital capacity is the whole thing of what you breathe in with a forced inhalation. So FRC is what's left after a forced exhalation. It's always there. You have no control over it. Why do we have that? Why did the Celestial Planning Committee say, we probably need to leave some gas in there? That's a hint. It does, to an extent, keep the alveoli open. That's true. We don't want all the alveoli to go on vacation when we exhale, so we then have to go every time to open them up. That's true. But there's another purpose for the FRC, too.
Keep the pressure.
With those alveoli open, we still have gas exchange going, even though we're not breathing, right? So FRC is important, and they lose it. Collapse of alveoli. So the ones that aren't flooded and the ones that aren't flooded often collapse. Okay, so picture in your mind, those are the balloons are collapsed. What can we do to pop them open?
Increase the pressure.
Here it comes, Pete. So their lungs become very stiff and non-compliant. They lose elastin as well, but it's more of a function of the loss of surfactant and the loss of FRC. The lungs are very stiff. And when you look at a lung and try to bag somebody that has ARDS, you understand what I'm saying. And you have to work to get that air in them from an ambu bag. They're that stiff. And that's why pressure becomes so important for trying with the motor. So signs and symptoms are going to increase airway resistance, and that's what the FTs, when they read those road curves on the ventilator, they can tell right away. They can actually measure compliance, but they usually know enough to be able to tell at what point they're inhaling and exhaling about airway resistance. And they'll also get that indication from the peak inspiratory pressure. So next time you go to drop that down. So when you go next time, all of us clinical instructors are going to take you on the side and walk through all that ventilator stuff at the bedside. And one of those numbers that you'll want to look at is peak inspiratory pressure. And that tells you if that goes up beyond 35, that we got a problem. Now it could be just secretions in the airway, any section, but it also could be that they're doing stuff. Refractory hypoxemia should be in yellow because that is the clinical indicator and confirmed by that one data X-ray and increased pulse pressure. Byronic is the last of, or the third stage, since I last, cellular granulation. It's an inflammatory process, and eventually there may be some scarring and some fibrotic tissue left that will not go away. So if it sloughs over time, but much of it becomes permanently scarred and non-functional. It can recover, but it's going to take very long time for them to recover. In fact, a lot of our COVID patients are still, after months, having a lot of what we would call chronic lung issues. The typical time, if it's a recognized case and they do turn around, is around 7 to 10 days that they may have pretty close to normal pulmonary function tests. But that's the best case. Any questions? All right. Early recognition is the typical thing you want to be sure to do. The patient who was, I can tell you all about my COVID in like a nutshell. I can count like 15 cases and I remember every one of them. This was a young lady who was from Monrovia. Y'all know where that is? I had to look it up on, you know. It's in Africa. She spoke very little English. Her husband spoke no English. And they had just had a baby. She was postpartum by 3 days. Came in with a urosepsis, urinary tract infection after delivering the baby. And she was tachypneic. I had all these signs. And so we advanced her. I took her on. I got her up to 100% non-rebreather. But antibiotics kicked butt, and she turned around. So she did not have to be intubated, but she was really scarier for a while as far as what we're going to have to do. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, they didn't have anybody to keep the baby. Guess where the baby was? Out with somebody that was sitting in the waiting room. The guy just handed his baby over. And this little old white-haired lady comes in and goes, "Look what I found." Yeah, it was a real social issue. But I remember it because it was a neat turnaround and a neat happy ending, although I was really disgusted. They're cultural things are something that sometimes makes you really, your first gut reaction to the father, because anyway, that didn't matter. But there were some issues. But the main thing is she turned around. And that's what you have to watch for and look for is what we're doing working. And 100% non-rebreather breather. Actually, I think we did have to put her on BiPAP for a little bit. But anyway, she didn't have to use that. What I want you to get across is early recognition and intervention, and sometimes they don't have to. But the highlight and the gold standard for treatment of ARDS is mechanical ventilation with positive end expiratory pressure that will inflate the alveoli, push some of that gas across that floating out alveoli, enough pressure where it recruits others. So that's the two upsides to PEEP. Better oxygenation, recruitment of other alveoli for even better. But there's two disadvantages. You're increasing pressure within the inner thoracic cavity. What else lives in that thoracic cavity besides the lungs? The heart. So we increase the pressure, and it might just push on that heart just a little bit to where it can reduce cardiac output. Now we'll start, just like we try to do with everything, we'll start at low amounts of PEEP, maybe 8 centimeters. 5 is physiological, by the way. When you go back to clinical, you'll see that all your patients are on 5, and that's because we're giving them back some of that FRC. But 8, 10, 12, as you advance that, you're going to see some changes in cardiac output. Now, how do you know that? You don't have somebody else. You don't have a swan. You don't have a blood draft. How do you know that? How do you measure your cardiac output when you have none of those devices? Blood pressure, that's right. And you're now putting all that stuff. Well, you're going to see the blood pressure rate go down. You're going to have to see cost versus benefit. Do we need to stay where you are with a peak and do something with blood pressure? Now, we go up and up and up, we're on 12 centimeters of feet. We had to go up. And remember, that's a little balloon. And we put more and more pressure on that balloon, and it will do what? Pop. Where's the air going to go now? It's going to escape the alveoli and go straight into the pleural space. Becomes a space-occupying lesion, lung becomes atelectic. What's that called? Pneumothorax. Barotrauma, besides cardiac output decrease, barotrauma is the next problem, and probably than we think. And it can be either a pneumothorax, where it rushes into the pleural space, or it can be subcutaneous emphysema. Sub-Q is oftentimes first. So when you do your assessment on these patients, you want to feel around, put the hands up, air rises. So kind of look to see, feel around here and see if you feel the snap, crack, or pop. Once you feel it, you'll never forget it. That's sub-Q emphysema. And that tells you they've had a measure of barotrauma. Will it kill them? No. If it gets into their groin, it probably hurts. I don't have one of those, but I bet you when it gets to be the size of a basketball, it hurts. So, yeah, anyway, not to say, it doesn't have to stay up here. It can get so bad if it leaks enough. When we're on high peak, like 12, 16, I've had some people up to 16 on peak, it's going to cause barotrauma. So you want to be watching very closely. If it causes a... Now, so what would be the size of a pneumothorax? Tell me, what do you think? Pneumothorax. Lung is now collapsed. No, not yet. But they're going to have all those signs of respiratory compromise. They've gone from two lungs now to one. So that's not good. So they're going to be tachypneic all over, their O2 set's going to be hitting the floor, and you think you've fixed everything, you know? You got them intubated and sedated, and everything's looking pretty good, and all of a sudden it goes to... So, we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to continue to support them, your oxygenation. And what you think the definitive? Guess what I got? And I just put myself in the column of provider, anticipating what? What's the treatment for a pneumothorax? 9 times out of 10.
Chest tube.
We're going to have to give them chest tube to release that air out of that pleural space.
Oh my God, y'all, we're only on slide 19.
As far as the patho and all that, and the care of the chest tubes and all that, was trauma. But I just want you to know that that is the biggest problem we have with, especially high feet, cardiac output, and barotrauma. Positioning also has become something that is very acceptable. We not only put the head up, but now we are starting to see with COVID, this, the Italians found very early that that was helpful, and now you, and it really is good to go through the MICU and not see every other room with a big red COVID sign on it. It is starting to turn around. So, this is what we'll find. Remember that lungs are posterior. When you look at the anatomy, the lungs are predominantly posterior. So we're just taking advantage of gravity, basically, by proning them. Now we'll have to unprone them, and that's a 6 or 7 man job because these people are very unstable. They will tank fast. O2 drops, blood pressure drops, they go as this way. Or bradycardia in play. Very fast. So, and my students last time had the occasion to actually unprone someone. The proning will definitely make a difference in their oxygenation status, as will from this complication. We're going to support tissue oxygenation. Again, they'll be sedated and paralyzed usually during this time to reduce myocardial and oxygenation needs. And we also can use extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is what they've used in severe cases of COVID. Now, ECMO, Denise will talk about a little bit tomorrow. Tomorrow, we are out of here, right? Anyway, But when she comes back, so be sure to write ECMO down. And as you get over the break, if you're just searching on the internet for, you know, a new pair of tennis shoes, click over and look at ECMO and kind of see if you can figure out why this is healthy. It is the most, it's probably the most aggressive tool that we can use to oxygenate someone who is not oxygenating other ones. Preventing complications with ours is extremely important within maintaining hydration, nutrition, and mobility issues. That's going to be a problem. We already know, we knew that this was a guy that had uncrumbed, we knew there was a bad mucus underneath. I forgot where this was, but anyway, he did have one in the sofa too when he was supine. But remember, paralyzing someone, you really do change the distribution of blood. So they're at high risk for DVT, they're at very high risk for skin ulcers as well, because gravity does work. Gold standard, again, for arms is mechanical ventilation with feet added. Early ventilation with the lowest FiO2. So again, we're going to try to keep them off those high percentages because that becomes a cycle that goes nowhere to go on. So we'll keep them on the lowest FiO2, the lowest feet, so we don't cause more problems with their trauma and hopefully reduce the effect of their organ. So this is their trauma, as well as the hinging part of the belt. But high feet, maybe what we have to do to keep from going at 100%. If they're requiring high percentages of O2 and high feet to keep them minimally oxygenated, that's when they start talking about ECMO. But usually when neither of those is working, that's what talking about ECMO. Permissive hypercapnia is another tool that's been used as a method of treating ARDS, and that's just where you allow their CO2 to get a little higher so that you're able to lower the amount of oxygen that you have to use. So in other words, you know they could use it. If we were going for classic normal ABGs, we shudder. But we'll let that PCO2 get up to, you know, like 48, even 50. But after that, they usually say, we can't go any further than that. But we're trying to stay off 100% of FiO2, right? So that's the balancing act that we have to do, is to get the best oxygenation with the lowest FiO2, and sometimes the lowest peak as well. And that's a real hard place to do the balance. They'll get bicarb only if they have a severe acidosis. Remember, with any hypoxic state, that's going to generate an acidosis, right? A metabolic acidosis is going to result. Everybody follow that? No oxygen, anaerobic metabolism, lactic acid, right? Right? Metabolic acidosis. So, what are your numbers going to be with a metabolic acidosis? Huh? What's your pH going to be?
Less than
7.5?
7.35.
Where's your PCO2 going to be with a metabolic acidosis?
It's going to be normal.
It's going to be probably normal, right? What's going to be off?
Just the bicarb.
Higher or low?
Low.
So let me give you some guesses. Okay? This is how it works. Don't worry about it right now. I'll send you all the answers. Isn't it mean for someone to give you homework over the break? Forget about it. We'll do that when we come back Monday. How about that? I'll email some guesses, and your clinical instructors will make sure you got it ready. Because the test is on Thursday, we'll come back, isn't it?
No.
Huh?
You don't have that.
I would prefer she send it to while I'm working.
The test is on Thursday.
I bet y'all, y'all don't have to get a lot of these things guesses, but you sure do know the count. All right, so, usually if they're 7.1, and we can't get them out of that range, by fair means or foul, then I'll think about by far is usually. This is something I like to read, and that's read the Critical Care Nursing Journal. This came from Urban, actually, but it's on eBay. It's on the web now. It's the motto of ours. So if you want to read that, that would be a really good thing to do because it wraps it all up in a very good way. Motto L is for the patient in severe respiratory distress, acute onset, and then it gives you your numbers, including occlusive pressure if they have a swarm. A is for assessed respiratory rate, depth of breathing, use of accessory muscles, all the way down to what the cardiac status is. The T is testing, and the other T is how will this condition be treated? So you have to, you can't walk away. If they have pneumonia, you got to treat that too, right? Or you're never going to get on top of it all. B is for how will you educate? So that's a really good tour for a student trying to learn about ARDS. All right, what happens if you get the virus? I wanted to make sure we said a couple of words about COVID. The severe COVID cases, fortunately, we hope will come down now that we have the immunizations on board with a lot of people. And we certainly see the statistics nationally coming down and locally. And I'm going to be honest, maybe kind of like a day, so y'all take care of yourselves, okay, over the break. Now go down to Miami Beach and let me see you. Okay. I don't care what was going on. Guess where Michael's going to be? He'll be the one with the shirt on. Anyway, the virus has a way, and this virus is very much like any other coronavirus in that regard, SARS and that kind of thing, in that it does go and target the lungs. It does affect other systems, as you know, but I wanted to make sure that I included this for you to kind of review for your own benefit. Truthfully, I don't know that I know enough about COVID to ask you questions, except that it does put them in arms. I don't know that any of us know all of it, not yet. So that was the Meridian experiment. Y'all want to take a break? Y'all talked about these foods, Signs and symptoms depend on the size of the illness. Approximately one third are present by sudden death. In other words, they're big enough to where they're gone, and they're getting them back. The ones that I've seen, they've either gone asystole or into a terminal defib, into asystole. Suddenly, one guy was getting ready to go home, packing his bags. The book on the side table was after death. Why that began to be a Christian book. It's kind of ominous. Description is your pot or other material, can be a fat in the lung, a tumor, amniotic fluid. We see that unfortunately. I was just thinking that there was a patient had a stroke, but I don't think it was amniotic fluid. Anyway, air, foreign bodies, any of those things that can disrupt the pulmonary artery or any of its branches. It's going to disrupt blood flow to the lung, as you know, and that's going to shut down that conduit for oxygenation, so no perfusion. And then you got ventilation and perfusion. And most of them do come from the big veins of the leg, so that's why we have the DVT prophylaxis that we do. But is that involved? Give me the rundown.
I don't know what she asked.
Low dose heparin. But what's the difference between Lovenox and heparin? Why would we go with Lovenox in most cases? Meaning what? What difference does that make? If you're giving her heparin, you're dancing with that brother. It. She said it. We also buy to do PTTs. So that's extra cost, perhaps. And they might bleed somewhere else besides just the site. Now they're getting 5,000, so let's pay the odds. It's not gonna make them hemorrhage usually for 5,000 twice a day. But it's still a possibility. When you're looking at heparin, you don't know. But it is a good drug. It's cheap. It's cheaper. And the patients tell me that it doesn't hurt as much as Levonox. So Levonox is 11 molecular weights, so no PTTs, nothing effective. And so that's why most people go home on some of these drugs. Like the orthopedic cases, we often go home on Levonox for a short time. They'll go home on Levonox because it's just got a higher safety profile. So some type of program. And then what? SCDs, right? And what else? You can do topos. Keeping them hydrated. It's one of the main things that we all need to remember. Especially when your students sitting for 4 hours. Anyway, so we also have to make sure that, now, the etiology of these, of course, is it travels up to the right atrium, and goes into the lungs, we know that. And we've done kind of with these big PEs, for people who have repetitive PEs, the traditional thing was to put them on an anticoagulant, send them home, and pray and have the vet, right? Wrong. We have to monitor them, and that's cost and expense and everything else, and the high risk of hemorrhage. So what they've now gone to are the Xeratos and Eliquises. So be sure to look those drugs up, review them, and know what the reversal agents are, because we still have a fair number of people who go home on Coumadin and Xarelto, Eliquis. Eliquis is really good to have a better prevent them, second profile. We're going to, with these big PEs, the way that they become so sick is hypoxemia from that 7BQ mismatch. No perfusion is going to make a big difference. So now what the, remember the failsafe that the body will do is it will shunt from those non-ventilated units to a ventilated unit. And if it's a big enough PE, it will cause a huge shunt to occur. And that's going to make a big difference in their hemodynamics and what causes them to have right heart failure. If you follow this, what you'll have is elevated pulmonary artery pressures very quickly. And that's the key a lot of times to the body's response to this, whether they're ill or not. The size of the embolus and the acute nature of it. Thankfully, most people shallower, smaller ones prior to, and they present with chest pain and shortness of breath to the ER. But those that don't will go into right heart failure very quickly because of that right ventricular bleed. That's when there can't be blood flow from the right into the pulmonary artery, then the pressure is going to build downstream, right? Just like if you put your thumb over the water hose. So it puts that right ventricle at very high risk of failure because it's going to try to push against and pump against that occlusion. And that's what usually their demise is due to. It's right heart, sudden right heart failure, massive right heart failure that leads to total collapse. Assessment, of course, the classic triad we talked about before. Sudden overwhelming sense of doom. Many of these people come in with this huffing and puffing and chest pain and something really wrong. And you need to listen to that. Apprehension, there's half of 44% of patients who have pulmonary edema do report a difference in their size of the cap and leg pain. So again, we need to listen to that too. It's not everybody, but it's pretty close to half. Palpitations, tachycardia, the red swelling, and of course, diabetes, diastasis, getting in trouble, getting your rash and squeezes, and that all comes from 2000 articles in Kramer and Schloss. Everybody's true, everything. Diagnostically, of course, we need to do the double ultrasound, and 44% are confirmed for that. Elevated D-dimer. Now, what's a D-dimer? the D-dimer, positive D-dimer tell you? Plots. In this case, it's in a real bad place. A D-dimer will also be positive with DIC, by the way. That is the aha in DIC. But in this case, it's part of the puzzle. Bottom degradation products indicate the bottom is lysine, so you'll have an increased D-dimer and an increase in FDP, bottom degradation products. Pulmonary angiography will be where many of you will find your patients go because not all hospitals have a spiral CT, but that is the standard of practice now, or the suggested standard of practice is to do a spiral CT or a VQ scan at the very least. Ventilation perfusion scans are done in nuclear medicine. They'll shoot them up the contrast dye and see what's going on with the lungs. With a spiral CT, they shoot them up with contrast, and then they do this all-around CT. Doesn't take very long, but like I said, not all hospitals, most of the bigger ones have them, not all the smaller ones. Collaborative management, oxygenation is the number one, of course, and then they have to be intubated and ventilated by that means for a while. Stabilizing hemodynamics, and this is right heart failure, so that becomes a little tricky. We've got blue balances to increase right ventricular freeload. Vasopressors and inotropes are almost always used as well. Aid evaluation is going to be achieved with heparin, of course. And now they may use high-dose Levonox, but in my clinical experience, they're still using more heparin. So initially, the heparin protocol will target that work. It's supposed to be 1.5 L. I'm sorry, not 15 times. 1.5. I just noticed that. Wow. 1.5 to 2 times the baseline. The baseline is usually somewhere around 32 to 33, I think. That's lab records, so you'll need to be checking that. But 1.5 to 2 times that is usually considered the therapeutic range for heparin, right? We talked about that in non-stims. The problem with that is you're going to have to do numerous PTTs because a lot of these people have a variation on coagulopathy because of what's happened here or how it's happened. The heparin is a bridge to oil, and we're using the warfarin, Xarelto, Aliquis, or Pyrexa. All three of those have been used, but I think the favorite now is Aliquis. But I do want you to be sure to look up these drugs. You need to know heparin. What's the reversal for heparin? What's the reversal for Pyrexa? There is one, by the way, so be sure and look. And I think, we were talking about this yesterday, as a matter of fact, in clinical. There's, I think, now a reversal for all of us. Because anytime you give someone an anticoagulant, you might as well give them an athlete gun because the risk of bleeding is so high. And when normal activity, normal people, remember my clogging guy? I mean, you never know what somebody's going to say, well, if you type it's okay to joke out of your plan by Latin throws out there. No. But so it's really an everyday thing. Shaving. All that bleeding, she said, look at all that. Protocol. You need to be sure and remind me. So know that. There's a protocol. Thrombolytics, they do use those with the large, very, very symptomatic, unstable patients. They will try to take them to cath lab immediately for surgery and shoot them up with TPA. And time is of the epic, really, I mean, it's really their fighting time in most of those cases. And you all know what TPA is, right? So if you should be able to fill in those blanks of who, when, and what, as far as we prevent those, who's at risk? When are they at risk? When are we all at risk? And what are we going to do to prevent and to treat? That's a little bit of a study gap. Anticoagulation, I know this is just a retread of what we just said. Side effects and knowing the protocols and knowing. Now, why do we tell people to take their anticoagulant in the afternoon? Why do we do that?
Because you're going to lay down and not run into stuff.
Could be, yeah.
Not as much
pride. Remember, we're going to be doing co-eds a lot. So if they take it in the morning and they come in for a clinic visit with co-ed checks, which they'll have to have every few weeks until we get them stabilized, we can do it. Good thumb bill, right? But if we have them take it in the afternoon, we can safely do a co-ed study in the morning with the clinic visit and then tell them whether to hold it, change it, or keep on keeping on. So it's a safety thing as far as being able to monitor and give them the correct information. And oh, by the way, we can use, if they're bleeding out from heparin or from anything else, we can use what's called Amicar. Amicar is a very potent coagulant. So it's one of those things that the protein doesn't work to reverse it, and they're exsanguinating, we can give them that. And sure, we're going to be giving them blood products too. Intravascular filters are another way. Now, this has actually changed as well. This is the old days, but they still get it done every once in a while. Inserted via an inferior vena cannula. It is really, it looks like a, here's a picture of it. But the filter actually has it filled in when it opens up in the inferior vena cava. It acts like a little filter. So if the clot's traveling up from the leg, it'll catch it before it gets through into the femoral. So those are inserted, and it shows here that where it's inserted. And the only problem is, here's another picture up here, they call it a greenfield filter, that's just a brand name. IVC is what the consent will be for it. But they can get all clogged up, and they'll have to be reinserted. But they do, for someone who keeps having them, despite being heparinized, and despite being anticoagulant, they keep having them, that's a good type of thing. Now, here's where I wonder, who was it that was working with the watchman? Was it? I wonder if the watchman's not going to take the place of this accident. What do you think? Would it do the same thing?
I don't know what the hell she's talking about.
That's true. It'd been kind of late for that. Oh, if it's on the other side of the heart, is it on the left?
Yeah.
See? She's going to have to tell us about the watchman one day. Surgical options, we can rush rather than the surgery and use also thrombolytic direct. But that's again a time thing. A thrombectomy might be an option if we know that we have one that we can go off. The ECMO can be used as a bridge to keep them alive. So there are some emergency types of things we can do to keep people alive. But it's a real time is of the essence kind of thing. The newest thing that I know we're using is the echosonic intravascular system. Now this is a new thing, so I'm not going to ask you any questions about it, but I just want you to have heard about it. For people who drugs don't work, and we know we've got a big old clot in there, they can put this, it looks like this. I've only seen it used twice now, but it actually acts as kind of a rotational, it breaks up that clot on a microscopic level by ultrasound. And kind of like lithotripsy, I wonder if that's where they got the idea. But anyway, it goes in, it's kind of rotors it out, and clears it out. So here it is, and these are all published conditions, of course. Here it is in the vessel itself, and the sound waves come from this catheter that's in, and then the sounds go all the way through the PA from this little sound here. So, pretty cool, huh? For every problem, there's a bunch of really smart people trying to figure out what to do next. So, that's a good thing. All right. Wrapping it up, we want you to have heard about this. Did y'all talk about delirium? It's good. So I just have to get the high spots where it applies to our patients who are ventilated and supported in ICU. We know it is cognitive functional and behavioral change that occurs with confusion and all those things that are listed in there. And you all talked about it, so I'm not going to read it out. The kid is progressive and situational. A lot of our patients already have a pre-existing risk. And the risk profile is anyone who's already had a brain injury, including strokes, in their history, someone who is over 65, we want to watch them very closely. We commonly call it sundown, and I know you've heard that. But it really is progressively where they lose, and this might be a stroke patient who's gained some ground, but because they've been in an environment where they can't sleep, you have to have a 90-minute sleep cycle to maintain your sense of well-being. That's a physiological, neurophysiological thing, okay? So they don't get that in ICU, or anywhere in the hospital really, but in the ICUs, there's also something else that happens. One is you're laying flat, surrounded by people doing this. Now, if you really want to know why that messes with your head or how it messes with your head at home, or maybe go to someplace where you don't know anybody. No, seriously, it really messes with your sensorium. You're not upright. We're meant to be upright. Our brains function at the exact kind of way. When you're laying flat for days on end, you don't know from Adam, it really takes away that psychological benefit of normalcy. Spatial orientation, it all kind of works together to decline or cause this decline in sensory. So now we first lose, the first thing I recognize in the patient is that they start picking. They start getting restless. And then I'll start noticing some change in the conversations, the content of what they talk about. They might repeat things over and over. And that goes on, and it's a progressive thing to where they're actually very disoriented and sometimes even having hallucinations and that kind of thing. So it is also called ICU psychosis or sundowning because it does get worse at night with the loss of circadian rhythm. You think about an ICU. Everybody been in an ICU at least once or twice so far? Did you notice that there aren't that many windows that you can see out of? And a lot of the windows that you can see out of, you're looking at a brick building. That was a real plus in the old days in CCU. They built on the ER. And in 60, you had this great view. You could watch the cars go by until they drove back, and then you had brick wall. Well, there is no way that they can keep that orientation of day and night, that circadian rhythm straight. So then they really start losing it. So many hospitals have tried to use those moving mirrors, and there have been some real stories told about those. I mean, like the moving started coming at them. Their minds really begin to decline. They do become psychotic. So by definition, a psychosis can be an acute disorientation, but can be reversed. And we'll see these people get 100% better after just getting a couple of nights of good sleep out of the ICU. So it becomes a real part of when we start seeing them really getting worse and worse on that end of things. And the physiological is getting better. We'll get them out of the ICU as soon as possible. And that will usually turn the around because it is a true psychosis. Disorientation, threatened behavior, and usually reversible. There are a couple of types. One is hyperacute. That's the one we see the most. They're picking and climbing and pulling things out. And it's really hard, but you want to maintain a safe environment. That's the number one challenge of a nurse who has a patient who has ICU psychosis. Restless, agitated, and very rapid mood swings. One guy was the nicest guy. He had a wonderful neck. He was so nice and so sweet. The next night, he told me, "Get out of my room. You're a drug dealer. Now, this was back in the day when we were exchanging the keys. That's where we thought, he must have gotten the idea, because we always made these comments like, who's got the keys? You know, I need to count the knocks. I bet that's where, and that's what you have to remember. When you're in this ICU environment, they can hear everything. So you might be talking about somebody that's long out of the ICU, or, you know, nothing to do with them, but they're getting incorporated into their psyche. And that may almost always be a bad thing, whether they're confused or not. It's really hard. It's really interesting when you walk in and they ask you about the nurse that just left, you know, are things okay with her boyfriend? But in this case, they're not incorporated into their relations. And that's what gets very, almost dangerous. And for me, the best thing to do was to change assignments. Got them off the drugs that were contributing back to being a really sweet guy, just like he was before, where they're just a 3-day stay. He's really pretty odd. I'm sure every nurse can tell you some stories about people who have had ICU psychosis and their behaviors. Hyperacute is like playing possum. They just kind of introvert. They turn everything, and they just look like they're sleeping all the time. And they're very unresponsive, or minimally so. And that's kind of hard to figure out sometimes, too. Is this drug effect, or is this I really honestly have not seen this for what it was. I can't really tell if they're sedated, over-sedated, but that's the way it was described in the test. Most of the women I have seen, where they go from being hyper-acute, being crazy, to and delusional, and talking to their mother who's been dead for a couple of years, you know, that kind of behavior that you've all probably seen. But the next thing you know, they're out cold. And you can't get them, you can't do nothing to get them to away. That's mixed very, very rapid cycle of that. Here's the risk factors that I was trying to do off the top of my head. It's age over 60. Presence of a brain and self already. Drug profile. Someone who has been on a drug for quite a while. Like, anybody want to guess? There's a type of delirium that we see all too often. 2 to 3 days after admin, and we don't give them alcohol. So DTs, delirium tea, which y'all talked about, and how do we prevent it?
If
someone has a high risk of alcoholism, you want to put them on DT prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. Or they're going to do this. And it can be a real problem if they've already had an MI, or they've already got some kind of pulmonary issue, like we talked about today, and they go into DTs, it might just kill them. And it can cause seizures, which might just kill them. So what do we do to prevent it? I know you're tired. Think about it. What?
Banana bag.
We can try using Ativan or, it's usually Ativan. Livering is what's in the old cocktail. That is when they're actually having the delirium. I'm talking about when we want to prevent it. Y'all didn't talk about DT protocol, prophylaxis in psych?
Yeah, it's been a while though. That was last semester.
Perfect. Thiamine, folic acid, B12. B12 is sometimes kind of iffy too, but what we'll do oftentimes in SI especially is give them what's called a banana bag. Mm-hmm. It's a bag of Ringer's lactate with an amp of MVI, multivitamin, which has thiamine, folic acid, and B12. It makes it yellow so it looks like a banana. So one liter every for 3 days will oftentimes keep them out of it. Now, the other way is to just give them routine thiamine, folic acid every day, a couple times a day. And that will hopefully keep them out of the worst case. Now, does it always? No. Because alcohol is not always the only drug these people do. So will it do anything for cocaine, methamphetamine, or any of the other party things that we... No. So with those types of dementias, usually they just get restless and irritable. I don't know if they actually get psychotic. We'll give them some either benzos or clonidine to tell your runners. So look at that joy profile, that really oftentimes can contribute. Both recreational as well as some of the common drugs that we that people have. I mean, a lot of people take opioids, you know, every day, and it's perfectly called for and appropriate. And if we take them off those suddenly, they can actually go through a withdrawal to mainly that there's a psychological problem. History of drug abuse, if we all said any of those recreational drugs, sex and septic shock, any of those things in their history make them at risk for acute delirium. So the contributors of drugs, withdrawal from drugs, food and blood balance, especially hypo and hypernatremia. So check those sodium levels. Blood sugar, same thing. Hypoglycemia will definitely change. So you want to eliminate these physiological causes and correct them before you jump on board with the GDOM, okay? Metabolic disturbances like hypoxia, and we can just check the O2 set, and you know that can help. Sepsis, kind of reflect back and see if they're infected, if the likelihood is that they're maybe getting into a sepsis situation. In a couple of weeks. Cerebrovascular events, they could be having a stroke. You have to suspend your disbelief because bad things happen in hospital all the time, as well as good things. Sleep deprivation. I think I told you the story of the radio disc jockey in Dallas. He went up on a billboard right as you go into Dallas. They had to go in and get him down after 256 hours they were doing a money thing. And that happens to our patients. We just need to let them sleep. And that's going to take you putting a do not disturb sign on the door and trying to get with your other collaborators, your other healthcare providers to say, hey, look, can we just let them sleep for an hour? That's not ideal. 9 minutes is ideal, but that ain't going to happen in the hospital. And I was trying to do this one night because I'm a real big, advocate for that. And I'll be gone. I had the lights low. I didn't just knock over the trash can. I kicked it. So I woke up everybody. But anyway, but you do need to try to collaborate and get some measure of rest for these days, especially at night. Don't let them do the like the babies will, oftentimes quickly. So what are we going to do? One of the things that we found that's helpful is called PAM. And what we're going to do is the PAM assessment method. It's a standardized tool that has been found to be effective in trying to identify and recognize delirium very quickly so that we can, differentiate it from other neurological issues. So the PAM has four features. And if you're any of these hospitals, it's on sorting. I'm not going to let you learn it because that's later on, okay? But just know that it exists and put on your homework for clinical day. Be sure to locate it on the sorting and on the Epic and get an idea of what goes into it. It's a little bit more of a mini mental thing than I think we can do on most of our patients because it involves them actually responding. But because of that, there is a CAM ICU version. My experience is, the current studies, a third of them have prolonged cognitive impairment. This is what's coming out in studies now, with PTSD and some of their cognitive things. And we are doing this, a lot of it, with the drugs that we give them. Those nurses that like to keep their patients snowed, they're doing this. That's why you need to use that Richmond Agitation Scale, why you need to use the term of force, because every time we keep somebody super sedated, it may impact their brain function permanently, and that's what they're from. Better than that prolonged cognitive impairment, lots of learning and comprehension problems. 75% with persistent cognitive memory and communication issues. And some associated with sedation and paralytic. And now they're looking at and doing PTSD studies on patients who have been ICUs on mechanical ventilator. So what we want to do is promote a safe, with any person who has delirium, no matter what the cause, safe environment, evaluate for those physiological causes like hypoxia, hypercapnia, drug use, good group result. I had a patient who became very seriously psychotic after Ragland. That's what I learned, the close association between Ragland and what to do with the drug. Y'all been inside? Mm-hmm. You know what it's related to? It's first cousin to the phenothiazine, the antipsychotics, stelazine, Malaril. Rather than study drugs inside? Oh, yes, sir. Because those drugs are just downright dangerous. You need to review those before you take them or even before you take that big thing in the skull and throw it in your bottle. What's that, contradictory? This drug has a serious side effects in this disorder. And the neat thing about it is, this guy with the hoodie, I mean, he was just absolutely psychotic. Took him off the Redland, he signed the next day. Ethical and human restraints are not the first place you go. But unfortunately, a lot of people do it because they think it's the best way to keep them safe. And maybe it is, but it should be first. Okay, so there's physical and there's human restraint. In both cases, it's behavioral restraint. So it puts you having to do a lot of assessment and a lot of monitoring for that safe environment. In many cases, it makes them a one-on-one. Have y'all seen that in hospitals or anywhere? Because it's such an unsafe way to do it. The regulations about restraints, did y'all talk about that in the first level? Good, I'm not gonna repeat it, but we sure know it. When there's a chemical restraint, now, these are the drugs that we've relied on for years. Now, why would Geodon not be my best suggestion for, let's say, a 78-year-old who is mechanically ventilated and has COVID? Huh? It prolongs the QT interval. That's why. We used to give it out like candy, and it's not the best. But now these aren't good either. They have side effects. So we sure look at Caldol side effects. That's one of our favorite ones. Lorazepam. And we've already mentioned it, so we sure look that up. And Seroquel. Seroquel given at night helps to maintain that night-day circadian rhythm, which is very helpful at the rear boost. Now, some final words, and y'all are going to textbook. We share and review and triage with all the hospitals, most of my testing, you know that I draw most of my test questions from this, but I do back it up with what to do. Follow-up study with ATI. You need to start looking at ATI, guys. So pull out your ATI guide. In fact, at the end of this, I have some questions. Let me go to it. First one is, a nurse is waiting the newly licensed nurse on the purpose of administering vacuronium to a client who has ARDS. Which statement by the new grad indicates understanding of the teaching? Okay, and your answer is? Shreveport. I'll let you have the first one. Everybody agree with that? Good. The answer is B. Next one. This is for you, Nagash. Wake up. It's just I can't see anything but the I can see this empty computer thing. So the nurse is reviewing the health records of five clients.
Tell me what to say.
Which client is at high risk for developing ARDS? Nerve recognition and early recognition is the key. This is selected on the five. Don't you love on?
Is
it
A?
Yes or no? Yes. Who's going to be the voice of the answer?
Is A correct
or incorrect?
Is A correct or incorrect?
A is correct.
A is correct.
It's a direct lung injury, right? What about status post cabbage? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Hemoglobin of 15.
No, that's normal.
No.
All that, well, it could cause aspiration.
Yeah,
aspiration.
It could cause aspiration.
That's right. And drug overdose.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. See. Very good, very good. Thank you for asking as the sample. Why don't we bring you guys the third one?
Great job,
Dr. Nurses assessing the client and the motor vehicle class. I'm thinking trauma. Trauma and ours, girl. Absent breast pains on the left lower with dyspnea. Blood pressure is 118 over 68, heart rate is 124 a minute, respiratory rate is 38.6 or 101.4, bearing my temperature, 92 on room air. Which action should the nurse take first? Alexandra, what's your answer?
Which I think?
Yes. Administer OTY high flow mask.
Go.